gotta figure out where the sound is coming out. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. It is time we begin. TechNet number 1548 of the series of TechNets that began roughly September 1982, 32 and a half years ago. As you guys have heard me say so often, and I've got to repeat this for the new people who come along saying, you know, what the heck is this? It's a gathering of the clan of curious radio amateurs that want to know how radio really works, want to know more information about those transmitters, receivers, transmission lines, antennas, propagation. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio, and we try to discuss quite a few of those. There's a very loose schedule we follow on this technical net, in which during the first hour or so, we discuss general questions and answers. That's followed by John to be to KC2WGB with the mailbag, which means people who don't yet have a ham license or don't have the right equipment so they can talk to us directly, send him a email, a snail mail, a pigeon dropping, or whatever, and we get some fascinating questions, particularly from these new young future scientists, high school and college kids, who are asking some very probing questions. Sometimes they really challenge the daylights out of us. You know what it's like with a young child who asks why, and you give them an answer, and then they said, why is that? And by the time they've asked the word why five times in a row, you as the answerer are probably in trouble. You dig deep enough, and you're always going to find out that you don't know what you think you know. So we try to handle those kind of things. After the mailbag pulled into WS2N, our space expert.
Repeater, timeout.
As I said, Paul, our space expert, will be delivering space report number 141, I believe it is. And, there's some exciting things happening with National Aeronautics and Space Administration in the last couple of weeks. In fact, it reminds me I've got to go run and get this beautiful article that appeared in Newsday magazine, a Newsday newspaper a couple of days ago. Very unusual article, a two-page spread on a very high-performance high school student who has been dreaming of being an astronaut. And my goodness, does she want to be an astronaut. Okay, after the space report, let's see now, the general questions, the mailbag, the space report. After that, we quite often dig into the deeper subjects, the more theoretical subjects. It doesn't please everybody, but you've been forewarned. If that's not the kind of material you want to listen to, well, there's 800 channels on your 2-meter synthesized radio. You can listen to one of the other 799 channels and or turn it off. Great job.
I believe Hal is with us also, Dick.
Yeah, I should mention that Hal K6DPZ is a man with a whole lot of radio experience, and he gives us the benefit of his wisdom. 1 or 2% of the time, I have a differing opinion with Hal. And so, as much of an expert as he is, and as much of an expert as I claim to be, you're going to hear both sides of the coin. I mean, when you get two guys that have both claimed a lot of radio experience and they got a differing opinion, you want to hear both sides. There's going to be some merit in each. There's no right or wrong, if you know what I mean. Let's see, there's another thing I was going to mention. Looks like I forgot it. The way a person signs into the technical net is to give that group of guys, Dick, John, Paul, and Hal, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Let me drop. You need not sign in just to let us know you're listening. A lot of nets do that. Have a long list of names and call letters of people who are signing in. After 32 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. So don't have to do that. So please only sign in if you do have a question or a comment. And in a minute, I'll show you what a typical sign-in sounds like. One other thing I want to mention to you is that there is Mike number one and Mike number two, who are drastically good contributors to the TechNet. Mike number one runs the website KC2NJI, which is at amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and there you'll find Mike number one's results of the last 7 years of recordings of all the ticknets, essentially all of them, 95%, 98% of them. They choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and they come in 1 hour reels. Since the ticknet is typically 4 hours long, there's four reels per weekend, 52 of them per year. Let me drop 52 weekends per year. Some of the people who really enjoy the ticknet information, and they might even been told by their college professor, there's a number of them in New Jersey, will tell the electrical engineering students, you ought to go listen to this thing called the technical net, and you'll get a little bit of an impression of what the real world of radio is like. And it's relatively different from the way it's taught in schools. Mike, number one, runs that website, and as I said, there's probably 3,000 hours worth of recordings there. And what some people will do, because they can't stay up until 12 o'clock at night without holding up their eyes with toothpicks, they'll wait a few days, 3-4 days, until that weekend's recordings of the TechNet are available on the website. They download it into some kind of a recording device and listen to it while they're commuting or on their lunch hour or whatever. So there's various ways of listening to the TechNet shifted in time. Let me drop. The other very good contributing website is Mike number two, and that is at the website of LimarkTechNet.com. L-I-M-A-R-C, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club is what that stands for, LimarkTechNet.com. And Mike number two has pictures of T2RIW up on top of his tower and his antenna. Various articles are, K1MJM, by the way, is Mike number two. Various articles that I've written over the years, Mike has collected those, and articles from also other people. I think AC2GS has an article there. So these are contributing websites that are complementary to the technical net. So as I was starting to say before, a person who signs into the TechNet does so by doing this. WA2PJF, veto, and yes. That's his call letters, his name, and he's letting us know that he does have a question or a comment. And if veto does sign in, I'm going to tell him I'll answer a question on anything except the Mosley beam. I know that's going to be his subject, and that's a goodie. Okay, so give me a call letters and name, right? In fact, Vito is already signed in. He doesn't have to sign in. I've got Vito on the list. Anyone else with a question or a comment, give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, that was a perfect double. I'm pretty sure I heard Rich and 2EO. Who was the other person?
Kilo Bluffy, Kilo Bronx down for Romeo, Gabe, yes.
Okay, I heard Gabe. Gabe, give me your call letters.
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo.
Okay, Gabe, M-A-R. Who is the other person?
Steve 2, Bravo, Mike Papa.
I think that's Whiskey Bravo 2, Bravo, Mike Papa. And your name, sir, is?
So Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike Papa, Joe, and I just want to make an announcement if I can, Dick.
And by the way, you notice how fast I recognize Joe. Terrible. He just happens to be the president of the club. El Presidente, please go ready. Please go ahead with your announcement, Joe. W2BPM, K2IW.
Thank you, Dick. I just wanted to let everybody know that we have a special event going. And it's to commemorate the 100th year sinking of the Lusitania. It's a rare chance for us to communicate with Ireland and England, who will also be on the special event. And if you're interested, you can work this special event from your home. Please go to the Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club website. Let me let it drop. That website is www.gsbarc.org, and they have a beautiful matrix set up, so you could pick the time and the frequency you want to work that. It should be a lot of fun. There's a lot of clubs in Ireland and in England that are going to participate, and it's a good opportunity to work HF in a fun environment. Thanks very much, Dick. Have a good evening. W2BMP, we're going to be listening on the side.
Very fine, Joe. That came through loud and clear. So far we have as sign-ins Vito, Rich, and Gabe. Joe already delivered his message. Was there any other person that wants to sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
comment.
Okay, we got W2RYY. Joe. And one last call. Anyone else? Give me your call list and name right now if you have a question or a comment for the net. Okay. And once in a while, we should drop the machine all the way to make sure the people on IRLP or EchoLink get a chance to sign in. We also have another function that John is doing. I hear tell he's got more hookups to his two computers this week that he's been working on. He monitors the EchoLink so that people who have trouble signing in, and John knows about it, and you can pass him messages by EchoLink, and he can read it off his screen. So lots of ways you can get to us. There happens to be another way that people want me to be able to do live on the air computing, and I don't have enough hands. I haven't volunteered for that one yet. Maybe I'll do some practice. So the first person who's really signed in, so to speak, is Vito. And Vito, repose your question so that other people know what it is. And I'm relatively sure I've got some good news for you. W2PJF, the microwave voice of, I think it's Bayshore. And by the way, Vito also is an expert on Home Depot. He goes to all of their mini lectures in service courses. So any of the equipment handled by Home Depot, quite often, quite possibly Vito knows about that. He also has a history of working for quite a few years for Ma Bell, so he knows a lot about telephone circuits. Go ahead, Vito, to B2PJF, K2RIW, the tech man.
Very good. Thank you, Dick. An old listening, WA2PJF, Vito Bayshore. Fine. Okay about the Home Depot. Yeah, I'm 18 years there. There's a lot of knowledge you pick up over there. Anyway, we'll get involved with that right now. My question once again, I have a Mosley TA-33 senior beam on a Rhone tower. I've had it for over 20 years, maybe 25 years. And it's been working very well for that period of time, but recently the SWR has climbed very high. So I removed the transit trap, which is the lightning arrestor thing in line with the coax, hoping that the plug was shorted to the shield or the whatever, to the ground or the center conductor, doing its job from a flash of lightning. But that did not resolve the problem, although it had in other antennas that I had in the past. So I was wondering, I called Mosley and I had told the technical department my issue. Let me drop. And I was advised that traps are due for replacement, the corrosion inside, whatever it may have been over the years. But my question is, first they told me it's over $400 to change all six of them. And my question would be, is it necessary to change all six? Can I just change the driven element, the one where the coax is connected to in the center? And would that resolve the problem and not being get involved with the radiator and the director? Director, radiator, three elements. But the one in the center that's driven. I was thinking that would solve the problem, I'm guessing. I don't know the answer to that question. Back to you, Dick.
A quick question also, Dick.
Yeah, good display there, Vito. And the word high biswa is a very relative word. To a guy who's using a no-tune radio, where at 1.6 biswa, it trips out, to him 1.6 biswa is high. To a person who's running an antenna tuner, or happens to have a DX100, old-fashioned Heathkit rig, for instance, or KWM1, any of these rigs that have a real Pi tuning network in the final stage, to them high biswa is 10 to 1. So my first question, Vito, before I go over to John, is, roughly how high was the biswa? Was it 1.8 to 1 or was it 12 to 1? Roughly what was the biswa, and you'll see why that is important. W2BJF, K2RIW, you got it, Vito.
We can very safely say about 12 to 1, very high. And the transmitter in question I'm using for that particular frequency, I operate 20 primarily, is the Collins KWM2. I do have an antenna tuner, but it doesn't seem to do much for me in this condition right now. Go ahead.
I think that's exactly right. That KWM2, if I remember correctly, it's got a beautiful Pi tuning output network. it can probably handle a 12 to 1 of most phase angles. In other words, most positions on the Smith chart where the 12 to 1 occurs. And if it happens to be outside of that range where the KWM2 high network can handle it, by just adding a little bit more or a little bit less transmission line, we'll rotate that dot on the Smith chart, the exact same radius from the center, the exact same visual, but it will rotate it to some other place, and in many cases that'll bring it back into the area where the Pi network or your antenna tuner can handle it. John's got a further question before we proceed with our what I believe to be good news. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I was speaking to Vito before. I forgot to ask him, did he prove the coax first? Is he sure the coax is in good shape? That's my only question.
That's been taken care of, absolutely.
Well done, Vito. Now, I'm about to express a fairly strong opinion. It's based on 10 solid years of working on various extremely high-performance three-element Yagis. I'll admit that I was doing that work at 915 megacycles, but one of the beautiful concepts about antennas, no matter what your antenna is, as long as it's got passive components, it doesn't have active amplifiers and circulators and isolators and gyrotropic devices and ferrites and whatever, as long as it's a real, ordinary, passive antenna. The beautiful concept about antennas is not only they all obey reciprocity, however they transmit the receive with the exact same gain, exact same pattern, exact same front-to-back ratio, exact same polarimetry, and so on. But another beautiful characteristic is they are beautifully adaptive to scaling. You take every single dimension of the antenna and change it by the wavelengths. I don't care if you're going from a 1.8 megacycle antenna and you want to build a version of it on 1296. As long as you scale every single dimension, you'll get the exact same performance of gain, pattern, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, side lobe amplitudes, and so on. There might be a little bit of difference in efficiency because the skin depth changes by the time you get up to 1296. But now, with that as a background, and 10 years of experience of tweaking three-element Yagis day in and day out, looking for, in my case, extremely high performance. I was adjusting three-element Yagis, let me drop it, to make sure that they did not exceed 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio. I'm not kidding. 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio from the frequency region of 902 to 928 megahertz inclusive. That's a 3% bandwidth. And I'm tuning for those very low standing wave ratios. In the process of doing all that and filing some patents, I learned an awful lot about what I think a Yagi really is. And here's part of what I learned. When it comes to the standing wave ratio that you see on the transmission line, it is highly dependent on the length of the driven element, the resonant frequency of the driven element, the way the driven element is fed, if you are feeding it with a gamma rod or a T-match or whatever, the physical dimensions of the gamma rod and the variable capacitor of the gamma rod, the impedance matching network, or the thing that launches the signal on the driven element, very important. So significant variation in the matching device that goes between your transmission line and the driven element, and the electronic resonance of the driven element. You change the electronic resonance of the driven element, I can easily give you a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio just by knocking it out of resonance. I'm not kidding. But now, if your driven element was working correctly, if it hadn't changed over the 20 years that you've been using it, Vito, let me drop. And if now I drastically detuned the director out in front or the reflector out in back, if I took either one of those passive parasitic elements and detuned them, I can take a perfectly matched Yagi and I could bring it up to maybe a 3-to-1 visual, not much more than that. In other words, the amount of coupling between the driven element and those parasitic passive elements is finite. 3-to-1 visual, maybe. This is very dependent on the individual design, but this is a rough order of magnitude. The fact that you've got a much higher visual strongly suggests to me that most likely your driven element is doing it. The reflector is probably beautiful. The director is probably beautiful, and I think it's all driven element. Therefore, I do recommend that you take apart the traps on the driven element for two reasons. One, when you take them apart, if you're able to get it apart, you being a very crafty guy may look at that and say, oh, look at that corrosion, look at that broken piece of wire, look at that disconnected capacitor or whatever, and you might see a way of repairing it. Then again, you might find out that after 25 years of ultraviolet exposure, the dielectric case for the driven element trap is so far corroded, and you see no simple way of replacing it with a piece of PVC tubing or whatever. Let me drop. Therefore, you give up on the process of fixing those traps. You, being a crafty guy, would take great pride and be able to find auxiliary components around the house or in the Home Depot store, like in the PVC plumbing department, and finding ways of replacing that which is broken in the trap, because I'm pretty sure that if you could x-ray, disassemble, or whatever that trap, guarantee it's fixable. But if you decide that, hey, this trap is too far gone, and I don't want to do that much heroics, and I'm going to buy a trap, and maybe because there's two traps on the driven element, maybe one of them is in bad shape and the other one's in pretty good shape, and you only got to buy one. So you could then go out and buy that trap and replace it. And once the driven element is brought back into electronic resonance, I guarantee you're going to be well under 3-to-1 Vizsla, even if there is a broken trap somewhere else. And the chances of those other traps breaking simultaneously is pretty slim. So I think we can save you some money. You don't have to buy all of them for $400. I think you can buy one or two of them. But I would recommend you take it apart first and inspect it. And in that process, you may not have to buy anything. Because either you and your craftiness or the other people you know, Andy and me and John, one of us is going to say, yeah, I got one of those fancy left-handed stainless steel hose clamps that will fix that particular one, and it's in the mail to you right now. So one way or another, that driven element's going to be brought back into resonance, and I give you a 95% chance it is the driven element that's doing it, Vito, and now you know why I've got that opinion. Don't guarantee it, but I told you what I think the odds are. W-A-2-P-J-F, K-2-R-I-W, you got it, Vito. Yeah, let Vito talk first, and then we'll over to you, Rich. Go ahead, Vito.
Very good, very good. All right, this is the things I was thinking, the situation at hand, and I was saying that the driven element more than likely is the culprit. Well, that's the first place to start anyway. So, okay, now what I would do, yes, I would take one down and try to disassemble it, but I know they're very difficult because I examined it in the past before the winter came, and I don't know that. They must have robots putting these things together, but once it's put closed, it's closed. But I'll see what's involved. But I would just go ahead and buy two brand new ones. I'd get the set, the pair, and be done with it, Richard. But okay, I wait till the weather gets better, and I'm hoping that this spring I can tackle that job. I want to thank you so much, as per usual. I don't want to tie things up any further, but you did answer my question, as per usual. God bless. Be safe. WA2PJF.
And Cleo with a further comment from Vito.
You're going to be disassembling the driven element, either to inspect those traps and or to replace them. And me being a guy who takes great pride in being able to fix things as opposed to replacing everything, I would have it disassembled. I'd be staring at it on the bench, deciding I can or can't fix it, and then deciding to buy. But you're willing to write a check and make the problem go away and buy the two traps, go for it, Vito. And please come back and let us know how this all works out. N2EO with some further comments on this one. Go ahead, Rich. K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I've taken traps apart and repaired them, serviced them on high-gain antennas and the Mosley. On the Mosley, it looks like six traps. It's actually two traps and one housing, 10-meter and a 15-meter trap. On the high-gain beams, they've got separate traps for 10 and 15. And, of course, the whole element is on 20. I'm trying to remember which is which, the high gain or the Mosley, but there are rivets there that you can drill out. You drill the rivets out, slide off the housing. Usually bugs get in through the weep holes that drain water over the years, they gotta be cleaned out, and the end caps, there are plastic end caps on them mostly. The older antennas were red, the newer ones were black. The black caps hold up better. Order new end caps. Now, the way they work, the LC ratio, Dick, there's a coil in there, and the housing is the other side, that metal housing is the seat, the capacitance. So what Vito has to do is, drill out the rivets, slide off the housing, literally wash them out in the sink, put them back together, re-pop rivet them. I'm sure you get a pop rivet gun at Home Depot, preferably stainless steel rivets, and put new end caps on. Back to net and to Leo.
Questions? For the comment. Go ahead, Vito.
Yes, okay, I know what he's talking about. I did see the rivets up there. No, I would definitely attempt to do something before I went and wrote the check, of course, which is my intent. But now that Richard had made mention of what the possibilities are here, of course, I'm going to research that first. And then I find that it's a waste of time and it's too far gone, then, of course, I would go ahead and make the purchase. But I'm just pleased to know that it's only two elements I should be playing with, and not all six. That's what my question was. Again, thank you so much, WA2, and thank you, Richard, WA2PJF.
By the way, Vito, I forgot to tell you. Where the coil goes and contacts the plastic to make with the metal, take the screws out and clean off the maybe oxidation. That's aluminum wire.
Very good, very good. Thank you for the further bit of information. Back to you, Richard.
20 years of exposure, ultraviolet, the whole works. There's a slim chance that it really is aluminum wire or an aluminum contact, as Rich just mentioned. You could be running into the problem that happened with aluminum oxide to start making scratchy contacts, and at RF that can happen rather easily. So cleaning it all up would certainly help. Whenever you clean aluminum and you want it to make good contact, I strongly recommend you use a product called Scotch-Brite. It's a kind of ceramic equivalent of steel wool. I do recommend you do not use steel wool, because when you're using steel wool, you're really scraping those very fine fibers of steel against the aluminum, and you're developing a steel-aluminum compound when you do that. And it's nowhere near as clean a contact as if you use Scotch-Brite on the aluminum. So by way of cleaning up the contacts, replacing the rivets, inspection, and in the case of, let me drop a
question in one YDY.
Okay, YDY in a second. Your older beam, which maybe has the red end caps, and red does deteriorate a little bit more rapidly in the ultraviolet exposure, whereas black is much more ultraviolet protected. If those end caps come off and the bugs and dust and everything else is able to, with the wind, go roaring down that piece of aluminum tubing that's your driven element, and it can get into the middle of the trap, it can create some grief. So those end caps are there for a darn good reason. And so, if need be, make sure the end cap is on and held on real good with some kind of very weatherproof tape and or a hose clamp, unless you're fairly sure that it's tight enough that it's going to have longevity on the end. It is kind of important on all of the elements. N1YDY, K2R, I didn't think of it, sir.
Rich recommended using stainless steel for the rivets. I was wondering why he did, because, you know, anytime you put stainless steel in direct contact with aluminum can create the potential for galvanic action. And since they sell aluminum pop rivets, and since you can easily dip an aluminum pop rivet into zinc chromate paint so that it's corrosion resistant when you use it, I would think that would be a better use of of materials for an exposed antenna and one YDY.
Yeah, Hank brought up an interesting point. Aluminum and copper are extremely dissimilar metals. I remember making a copper strap as part of the gamma matching rod on the driven element of my six-element Yagi way back in the dark ages of 1970 when I was heavy on 6 meters with a six-element Yagi. Beautiful band, by the way. But that copper strap wrapped over the aluminum, boy, it developed all kinds of grief. And I looked at the dissimilar metal table, found out that copper and solder are not dissimilar. Aluminum and solder are not dissimilar. So I simply took that copper strap, cleaned it up, and coated it with solder, and after that it worked like a charm. Other than that, I was getting very intermittent contacts. Now, are those two materials called stainless steel and aluminum, are they dissimilar? And there's various brands and mixtures that make up something called stainless steel, maybe. And if you did use aluminum, let me drop. An aluminum pop rivet, although it was a screw. If it was a screw, then I would prefer a stainless steel screw. If you had the ability to buy an aluminum screw, and I've got some of those, I don't recommend using them. They're not strong enough in most cases, unless it's a very, very expensive alloy. But if you are going to make aluminum to aluminum contact, that Nolux, I think, is one of the brand names of material probably sold at Home Depot. In other words, if you are using a wire nut on a pair of aluminum wires in your aluminum wired house, and you're using the right kind of a wire nut intended for that, some people will also coat it with a material called Nolux, a material that, in theory, eats up the aluminum oxide and keeps the contact in good shape. And so that might be a recommendation as to a better way of putting it back together with some longevity. Pretty sure when you've got that all apart in your laboratory, Vito, you're going to see some good approaches as to where to go from there. I give you a 95% chance you're going to be repairing that trap. And that's what I think we're going to be hearing next week. And with any further comments on the Mosley TH-33 beam and its traps that Vito's in the process of replacing, give us your comments right now. K2RAW in the TechNet. Okay, we're going to move on. And Rich, into EO, what would you like to talk about tonight with your new 590 rig? Into EO, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. I wish Vito luck. They're not very hard to service. Once you understand what that trap actually is, the L is the coil inside, and the C is the housing, which doubles as the capacitor. Parallel LC network, that's all it is. And Vito, check the weed poles in the bottom of the traps to make sure they're clear. That's where the water drain is. I haven't set the 590 up yet. I didn't even take it out of the box yet. I've got the IP880 set up here on the dining room table. It's D-Star radio that I'm on. I gotta wait until the contractors do their job in there and I get tables put up before I set up the 590. But I'm trying to decide what kind of antenna to put up. I got my tongue hanging out when Vito talks about a TH-33. I don't have the wherewithal, the money, or anything to do it here. I'm going to put up something. There were two trees spaced like they were made for me. And the old trees, I believe they're oak, the very, very fat trunks. If you went to kiss your girlfriend like you would, if you put your arms around those trees like you went to kiss your wife or your girlfriend, you could not get your arms around those trees. And me and John till last night were talking about the best way to secure an antenna without killing the tree by getting the bark off. I wonder if you agree what John said was to go with stainless steel 3/16 inch stainless steel wire, put it tie it off with end, clamps. I wonder if you agree with that. And also what I want to do is either put up a dipole with center fed, with open wire line, or there's a company I saw in the AES catalog. I think it's called Radio Waves, spelled W-A-V-C. I want to give them a call. Not much information. It's bowing in the center, which is an off-center fed dipole. And I don't know how they're doing it, but it's 67 feet long, which is just about right. And they say it works 8 and 10 meters. They don't mention with or without a tuner. I assume without. They don't say tuner needed. I'm going to give the company a call. What bothers me is they got two versions. One is good for 300 watts. One is good for 1,500 watts. One for lower power is $129, and the high power one is $229. I don't know if I'm being a sucker or not. Go ahead, Dick, back to that and to Leo.
Over the years, I have taken my inverted V 80-meter dipole, and the center was held up by the 100-foot-high tower, and the ends went over to trees. I've made lots of contact to oak trees over the years, and almost all of those contacts to the oak tree failed for two or three reasons. Yes, whatever wraps around a branch, a trunk, or whatever of a tree should have a layer of rubber underneath so that the metal is not digging into the bark. And you have to recognize the fact that the tree grows in girth. No matter where you grab a tree, if the circumference of that part of the tree you grabbed is 3 feet today, in a couple of years it's going to be 4 feet. It's going to grow in girth by another layer of bark that grows on top of the layer that's there. So you've got to accommodate that. And if not, you're eventually going to have your support structure underneath the bark. It'll encompass it. And that does give the tree some grief, so you got to accommodate that. Another thing you've got to accommodate is that the tree is going to sway an amount that you wouldn't believe. From my tower to the tree on the north side and the tower to the tree on the south side, I had at one time a whole bunch of cascaded door springs. And I think my door springs would have been able to accommodate about 2 feet of change in length because the tree sways. And both of those door springs within a year were broken. A windy day comes along, and I think the top of my oak trees, I say top, I think my oak trees at about, I guess the place where I was attaching was about 50 feet above the ground. I think that was probably moving as much as 4 or 5 feet. So however you attach the end of your dipole to that tree, as the tree sways, as long as you're not grabbing it right at the base of the tree near the ground, anywhere from halfway up the tree to the top of the tree, it's going to sway a ridiculous number of feet by way of pulleys or great big springs or something that stretches a whole lot. You have to accommodate that or you're going to get a failure. So the tree really moves. Over to you for any comments on this one, Rich. N2EO, K2IO, OEU, or also, let me drop. Any of the dipole-like structures that you buy, whether it's too short, the right length, or whatever, with your experience of feeding with open wire line, and the nice thing about open wire line is that if you had, let me pick a number, a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio, something that's really out of sight, because you've taken a 80-meter dipole and you fed it 40-meter antenna, a 40-meter signal, and you will get the, I think I estimated 1,500 ohms of reactance. Divide 50 into that, you're going to get maybe a huge visuar. As long as your antenna tuner has enough range to it, and as long as you've got low enough loss feed line like open wire line, that whole system will work with 90% efficiency. You feed that with coax, and you're going to get 5% efficiency, because when you get to extremely high standing wave ratio, coax becomes very lossy. Open wire line can handle it. So what dipole you use almost doesn't matter. If you feed it with open wire line, whether it's too long, too short, brand A, brand B, brand X, doesn't matter. It's going to be a 95% efficient antenna if you feed it with open wire line and you got an antenna tuner of enough dynamic range. That's an opinion. You've heard my little speech so often on the infinitesimal dipole. That's way, way too short. And with the right feeding system and antenna tuner, you'll get 95% efficiency out of it. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Limark, N2EO. So I think what you're telling me is forget about using the trees at all. I mean, I've got 80 by 100 property here. What do you suggest? Maybe I can figure out a way to come off the roof and make an inverted V and put stakes in the ground. I don't know. I got to look over the property, you know?
U.S. to us.
Now, Paul recognized I did not tell you to stop using the tree. All I'm saying is that you have to be a little bit mechanically smart. In the way you attach to the tree, you have to accommodate a hell of a lot of sway, a lot more than you think. People do it with pulleys and weights and halyards and springs. There's a zillion ways of attaching to a tree. Because the tree is in the right location, high enough up, it's hard to deny it's an ideal attachment point. So don't give up on the tree. Just accommodate it. You're just going to have to work a little bit harder in the method that you attach your end of your dipole or the center of the dipole to the tree. Let's see what Paul's got to say. I'm trying to remember how tall the trees were at your house, Paul. I think you've got some 75-foot high oak trees, which I bet you've been tempted to use. In fact, I'm trying to remember now. The end of that dipole on your house, where was that attached? We're about to find out. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, remember, I did have all trees holding up two dipoles. One G5RB, and then a long one, the 80-meter dipole. That also, everything's on trees. Naturally, the 2-meter is on a homebrew pipe tower, not high up. But the trees, you know, all the things you mentioned before are a problem. Even the if you have a rope or a wire holding something up on a tree limit, over time, over a couple of years, the bark will grow around that wire. You'll never get it out after a while. I've come across that. To avoid any problems, what I've done is use, instead of rope coming down and holding the dipoles up, I use 12-gauge wire. I just tie it, you know, knot up an insulator, you know, instead of using rope, and I come all the way back down the tree. And then at the tree, what I'll do, I made up belaying pins, made my own belaying pins, and attached them to the tree with rope. Because the tree diameter will grow eventually. Eventually, you're going to have to change the rope. So the rope goes around the tree to this bracket, which holds this homebrew belaying pin, and down comes my 12-gauge wire, and I just, you know, tie it off like you're on a boat, and makes it easy to undo if you want to change something, or, you know, make it tighter or looser. And because of that system, I don't really need to have the center of the dipole, you know, which usually has a ballon or an insulator on it, whatever you're using, held up on the, you know, I don't make an inverted V. It's just strung from, you know, there's two points of contact on both ends of the dipole. That seems to work pretty good. I've tried the pulley system. It's okay if the trees go slow. I had a big, heavy block, cinder block, one of these very dense blocks, you know, not the average in the block, which weighs probably about 20 pounds. This thing was about 30, 35, and because I tried the lighter ones, and they just sway all over the place. And so I've tried that with the pulleys, but when the trees really blow, it moves so fast that the weight can't
you know, pull it taut enough, and you wind up with this, like, shocking action, and that tends to rip the wire, whatever you have tied off on this thing. I mean, nothing could survive that. So I found that really doesn't work too good. Back to you, Dick, WSUS.
Okay, now, I'm pretty sure you are using a tree as a support on the end of your dipole. The tree is going to sway a lot. The halyard system that is shown in the ARRL antenna book and some of the QST articles and some of the handbook articles shows a pulley attached to the tree by various techniques, a rope going through that pulley coming down to a weight, and I think you're saying that didn't work very well. You talked about that belaying device. By the way, belaying is a slang term that's used with the people that do mountaineering work, rock wall climbing, where you've got a person on the ground protecting you, the guy that's climbing the wall, and that person is keeping tension on a rope, which is attached to various protection hardware that goes into the wall, and so you, the climber, can only fall as far as your last piece of protection, and that fall gets arrested by the guy on the ground holding the tension on the rope. He's doing the belay, as it's called. So you made some kind of a device where you can, I guess, allow the rope to slip and then reattach, re-clamp onto it, so to speak, whether the rope is waved back and figure eight weaved back and forth between two posts, or I'm not quite sure how you're doing that. But the one thing that's not clear, Paul, is that your tree is going to sway. You're using the tray for support. The very heavy, let me drop. The very heavy cinder block was not enough or not adequate. What did you use as a method of attaching your end of the dipole to the tree that can accommodate, let me pick a number, 4 feet of sway of the tree? In other words, the length of the rope between tree and dipole probably has to get longer and shorter by 4 feet peak to valley when the tree does maximum sway. And so you used to accommodate that with a pulley and a 30-pound cinder block, super cinder block. What's accommodating that now, Paul? How will you accommodate that sway of the tree? In WS2N, K2RIW in the deck net.
Well, it's just the strength of the wire. I mean, you know, the wires are essentially tied off at both ends. That's why I have these pieces of wood. I call them belaying tin type of thing, like you would see on the side of an old... You know, an old ship with rigging, you know. Now with a rope tied off somewhere. That type of thing. I made it out of a 1-inch dowel rod. When I became a ham, I tried these different things with the bricks and the pulleys. And it didn't work out, and I remember speaking to George W2CJN, an old-timer boy. He was a very knowledgeable guy, and he's gone now, but he said, if you don't go all the way up, you're going to get tremendous sways if you go very high up in the tree. Go about halfway up. He goes, he's got dipoles in his trees, it's on the North Shore, for decades, and not once did he ever have a problem of them coming down. So I said, okay, we'll try that. And I tried that system. But I tried it with ropes and everything, and ropes don't, the weather gets to it, the squirrels bite through it, you know. So I gave up with that one with that 12-gauge wire, had some stranded 12-gauge wire, and used that, you know, for a tie-off. That's all I did to expect, you know.
Now, if you were attaching as high up in the tree as you can get, where the tree gets down to some very thin branches, and if you have an extremely strong attachment point, you can literally stop the tree from swaying at that point. And everything below that point would just bend back and forth, so to speak, if you've got enough tension on that. If you go halfway up a 80-foot or 70-foot tree, 35 feet above the ground, that tree has got a lot of leaves and branches above you. It's got a huge momentum. And if it feels like moving 4 feet, and you apply 500 pounds of force to stop it from moving 4 feet, it'll only move 2 feet. You know what I mean? But it's going to move. It's going to exert some extremely strong forces. is your piece of steel wire underneath that piece of hose wrapped around that branch, is it capable of tolerating that kind of pounds of force, pull? How in the world did George do it, and how in the world are you doing it, Paul? That middle of that tree, I think, can easily generate 500 or 1,000 pounds of force when it wants to sway. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I've thought about that, too. But I've never, you know, let's see, it's got to be, I mean, other reasons, rope breaking, things like that. But as long as I had it done with the 12 gauge copper wire, you know, just regular copper, not steel wire, but just, I wanted to use, you know, flexible wire, you know, stranded wire. It's always better for movement. But just that tied off was good enough. I looked at it in the wind, and I often thought, if I had just one side on the tree and the other side, let's say, with an eye on the, bolted into the house or something. When the trees move like that, I mean, either the wire's going to break, it's going to pull the eye out of the, out of the house. But because there are two trees, you look at it, and when the wind's blowing, it's almost like they're blowing together, you know. it's not like one tree is going one way, and the other one's going the other way. It's that kind of an effect when you go out on a windy day, Dick. So I wonder if that has something to do with it. But I've never had that failure.
Hey, Paul, you've got an interesting approach. The two ends of your dipole are on two nearly identical trees. So your property is flat enough, the land around you is flat enough, that most likely you're getting fairly laminar wind flow. Therefore, when the wind blows those trees, the two trees are most of the time blowing in the same direction. So your center is shifting back and forth. You've got to make sure that you've got enough play in the way the center is supported. But the two ends of the dipole are just hard attached, and let them sway together. That's an approach. Now, when it comes to making compliance, there's something that's used in radio control model sailplanes called the High Start, which I've used. It starts off with 100 feet of surgical rubber. I think the surgical rubber was around 3/8 of an inch in diameter. There, I'm not sure of the exact diameter. I'm talking about outside diameter. 100 feet of that, and I believe it was 300 feet or 500 feet of monofilament line. And so you attach the surgical rubber to a stake in the ground, a very strong stake. You get to the far end of that monofilament line with a ring and a small parachute that's attached to a hook on the bottom of the sailplane. You pull that back another 200 or 300 feet. You end up with 12 to 15 pounds of force on the surgical rubber. You've got a couple of joules of stored energy there, and you let go, and pretty soon that airplane is 600 feet in the air. Works like a charm. So if I use surgical rubber tubing as the compliance going to the tree, it would work like a charm, because it gives me all the force I need, and it's got a tremendous amount of compliance. That's the good news. I know darn well that surgical rubber tubing with ultraviolet exposure, I don't think it would survive 1 year. And is there some way we could protect it? I don't know. Somebody must make a springy material. The door springs that I used, I...
Repeater, time out.
I never put enough cascaded door springs together, because I was way too optimistic in estimating how much the tree is going to sway. Had I used enough door springs that are painted with black paint so that they can tolerate outdoor exposure, there was a kind of spring that I could buy in my local hardware store at the time. Had I used enough of them, I think that would have worked like a charm. Each of my door springs had failed. When I inspected the failed door spring, it either had rusted through somewhere after a couple of years of exposure, or had been over-pulled, and it gave a fatigue failure because of cyclically being pulled much too much. So had I used enough door springs, I'm positive that would have worked. So that's the only thing that I see, Rich, that you've got to give some more consideration to. I don't think you should stop using the tree, because it's too convenient. And with enough mechanical smarts, guarantee it can be done. And your original question, should you use brand A, B, C, or X of dipole, as long as it's fitted with open wire line with the right antenna tuner, that doesn't matter. That's like asking, let me drop it.
That's not quite.
Yeah.
Okay, we got somebody who's going to give me some more information. It's a little bit like asking, should I use a 832 screw made by brand A or brand B? Doesn't matter. Who's the person who just joined us by EchoLink? Give me your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your information or question. Over to you, sir. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Dick, this is Rich. K2UB at Mobile. I'm in Pennsylvania right now. A couple comments for Rich is, one, when he has the contractors in, he should probably put like a dryer vent through the wall, make it very easy to run multiple lengths of coax in and out of the house, and then you can stuff up whatever space isn't used with the coax with some foam to keep the critters and bugs out. You want to cause the least damage to the tree, use a stainless steel screw eye. Don't try to wrap around a branch or the trunk. You'll damage the bark, and that will hurt the tree. You can put multiple screw eyes into a tree that size, and it ain't even going to know it. It's like you're getting a splinter in your finger. Anyway, you won't even feel it. I put up a lot of dipoles at my parents' house when I was still there, and I used a combination of springs and not going that far up in the tree. I also did not pull the antenna tight so that it was level with no wind. I let it sag a little bit so that then the antenna is going to absorb some of it as well. It'll just go up and down. If you're talking about an antenna with a large ballon in the middle or a center-fed dipole that's going to be high coax hanging down, it's also a good idea to use a messenger line so that the antenna is not supporting itself. The messenger line is holding the weight of the antenna. That can help also. That's just some suggestions from my end. Take back to you.
Yeah, very good information there, Rich. And you're absolutely right on the screw eye going into the tree. That's just like a splinter as far as the tree is concerned, like a splinter in your finger. I have successfully wrapped wire around a medium-sized branch of a tree with the rubber underneath was literally a piece of automobile tire that I cut up with tin snips, a very rugged piece of rubber, with the tread of the rubber toward the bark and the wire sitting on top of the what really was the inner lining, so to speak, of the automobile tire. And I made the loop around the tree a large enough teardrop-shaped loop so that the tree branch could grow twice as much in diameter, and the play in the wire and the amount of rubber all had compliance. So I've done it both ways. I've done it that way with compliance over the bark, and it's got to be more than just a piece of rubber hose. It's got to be something a little bit more substantial. As I said, I used a piece of old automobile tire, full-size tire from an automobile, where the tread was getting quite low, and that's the reason why I had abandoned that tire. And I've also put screw eyes in the trees. Let me drop them. And the screw eyes held up a KU-band dish that worked very well for at least 5 years. And then I had a mechanical failure of the dish itself, not the attachment to the tree. And the bark grew up quite a few more threads on that screw eye. It was a long screw eye, and the bark expanded itself quite a few more threads, but it didn't get up as far as the eye itself. Although I've got to now go out there and re-inspect that one. For all I know, that particular screw eye has completely disappeared. It's a fairly large maple tree, I think it is. So, it can be done. Now, this messenger cable you mentioned, the messenger cable went from where to support the dipole. Give us a few words on that one, Dick. That sounds like you've got another interesting breakthrough there. K2UPS in Pennsylvania, mobile. K2RIW in the TechNet. Comment. I will get you right after Rich. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, thank you. K2UPS mobile. The messenger line supports the weight. You instead of attaching the antenna between the two trees, you attach the strongest, like Dacron or UV and weather-resistant rope that you can get, or cord, and use that to run between the trees, and then you suspend the antenna from that line. So the line is taking up the tension from the ends of the support, and the antenna is basically just holding itself up. It's not trying to hold the trees back. And another thing, I had mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when he came on.